Accession number 28685, Mr. George Mail, Reel 2. Now, we're talking about the sort of time that war broke out. Now, on the day you'd installed your Anderson shelter, you tried to volunteer for the Royal Army Medical Corps, and they just weren't interested because they were too busy.
The next day, I told the medical superintendent, George Larks, and he said, oh, you won't be able to go into the forces. You'll be reserved occupation because you've got to get these six hospitals, all this equipment set up. Well, that was September. October, November, nothing had happened. The stuff was still there.
Well, and the emergency hospitals hadn't been set up?
No, it was all still there. And then in November, somebody said to me, they'd seen an advertisement, the Navy wanted specialist ratings in the sick birth branch. They wanted radiographers, masseurs, pharmacists, and operating theatre staff. I thought, operating theatre? Well, I know the names of most of the instruments, and I've worked in this hospital for 3 years. So I spoke to Mr. Larks, and he gave me a letter which is in this file. It merely says that I'd worked in the hospital for 3 years and I was a young, keen, intelligent young man.
Now, you hadn't had any real medical experience, opposed to...
The only time I'd been in an operating theatre was when I was 10 and had my appendix out.
So it was more that you had an interest and you'd had access to technical manuals,
yes,
and things, and you had a familiarity with the equipment, but not a practical familiarity.
Absolutely.
Now, you volunteered, you got the letter. Now, what was the process by which they took you in?
I sent the letter to Bristol, and 10 days later, I got a letter calling me up for the Navy. And I went to the...
Now, had they not done a fitness check, you know, or an intelligence test or anything like that with you?
Not at all. Not
so
at
no
all.
Medical?
Yes, medical. I'm just coming to that. I went to the... which was the museum and library, the big building in Plymouth, which had been taken over as the recruiting office. I went there, I was examined by, I think, three or four doctors, and then I was given 4 shillings and a large envelope with papers in and told to report to the naval barracks at Devonport. Well, I lived within walking distance of the naval barracks. My brother, one of my older brothers, had joined the Navy in 1937, and I knew the first thing they did was cut his hair. So I went to the barber's and had a sixpenny short haircut. And then I went home to Mother, dinner time, as we used to call it then. And she said, what's happened to you? So I said, I'm in the Navy, Mum.
And what did you think? How did you react?
Oh, well, she wasn't at all surprised. She knew that as I was just 20, I was due for call-up anyway.
Now, what the RN Barracks, does it have a name? Is it
HMS Drake.
Now, what was your reception when you went there? You'd had this haircut?
Yeah, I got this big envelope. I went to the main gate and they said, you go to the Officer of the Watch office. Well, I went to this place and they opened the envelope up, stuck some stamps on it and gave it back to me and said, go to the drill hall and wait for instructions. The drill hall was a huge building and it was seething with sailors. A chief saw me, I was in civvies, you see. What are you? I said, well, I've just joined the Navy, chief. He said, well, go down to the basement and get yourself a tin hat, a respirator, and an identity disc. So I did that. I came up again, and I bumped into a sailor who turned around. On those days, you had a khaki shoulder band on your respirator, and on that they stamped in white your name, G.E. Mail. I bumped into this chap, he turned around, and on his webbing was G.E. Mail. He didn't know each other. He was a Cornishman. We had a brief conversation. I never saw him again. I saw this chief again, and he recognised that I'd got a local accent. "Where do you live, boy?" he said. I said, "Just down the road, Camel's Head, chief." He said, "Well, bugger off home and come in again 8 o'clock in the morning." So I went in the morning, and then there were wooden huts put on.
Now, they hadn't given you a uniform yet.
Oh. They were very short of uniforms and short of everything because they'd been calling up all the reservists and so on. I was told to report to... there were wooden huts built on the recreation, on the parade ground, and one was miscellaneous ratings, and I was a miscellaneous rating, so I went in there, and there were 20 or 30 chaps, I suppose. Some had got some uniforms, some hadn't, and there was a petty officer, an old chap, old, he was in his 40s, I suppose, called Dickie Bird. He was in charge, and somebody had done something which had upset him. And he said, "If you do that again, I'll kick you up the ass till your nose bleeds." And I've never forgotten. I thought it was such a beautiful expression. So I used to go into this hut in the morning, and at 3:30, Liberty men would be piped, and we'd all troop outside and then go up to the gate and disperse.
You just went home?
Yeah,
you
I used to go
home.
Yeah.
Now, what were you doing in the hut? What kind of training?
Nothing, just standing up. Just standing up. When it was dinner time, we used to wander out of the hut, go up and find one of the messes, and go in and get a meal, and then come back to the hut until 3:30. Well, this only lasted a couple of weeks. During this time, I had to go up to the central stores and attempt to get kitted out. I got various bits. I did get a hat, and I got a uniform.
Now, which uniform did you get?
Well, it was called four and a half rig. That is similar to this, a jacket and trousers, not bell-bottoms. Oh, my first day, I said they gave me 4 shillings and then the next day, I was rated as an operating specialist and given 6 pence a day, special money. I was in the barracks for...
So even before you'd been trained or anything, you were getting the money?
Yeah, no such thing as training for me. A couple of weeks went by, I'd got some uniform, and then over the tannoy they piped that I had to go to the sick quarters and pick up transport to the Naval Hospital. The Naval Hospital was Stonehouse in Plymouth. A huge establishment. So I was taken to Stonehouse Hospital. I was shown on the map where the operating theatre was, and I was told to find my way there. I don't know whether I should tell you this bit, but
you'll be all right.
The hospital was in a big rectangular shape, with a big lawn in the middle. There were various blocks, A to H, around the sides, and administrative in the centre. And in this big lawn in the centre, there were two pathways across, and where they crossed, there was a pond. I'd walked across towards this pond, and I'd just passed it when I heard a voice say, "You! Hey, you! Come here!" I looked around, and there was this chap in officer's uniform of a sort. and we'd passed where the pond was. "Do you know who I am?" he said. And he got a white dog collar. I said, "I presume you're the hospital minister." "I'm a naval officer, and when you see me, you damn well salute me and put that in your pipe and smoke it." And I thought, what a thing for a minister of religion to treat somebody. And I was obviously a young rookie. Well, I got over to the theatre. They gave me a green gown and a green cap and a mask and said, "You're in number two theatre." So, so that was my introduction. I did no training. But there were two retired chief petty officers who'd come back as civilian employees in the theatre. One was Frank Best and the other was Ernie Scarrett. Frank Best was in charge of the sterilising room. There were two theatres in the theatre block. It was quite an establishment, was the theatre. We'd got two theatres, a big anaesthetic room, and then we'd got the sisters and the VAD's quarters, and we'd got our own quarters with beds, where, because we would, when we were on duty, we slept in the theatre block. I attached myself to Frank Best, who was in charge of sterilising. He was a dear old chap, and he helped me a lot. I was only there a couple of weeks.
And what kind of duties were you doing? Could you give us a sketch of your duties?
Yeah, well, there was what is known as a general operating set, and this contained everything that you'd use for an abdominal operation and various other procedures. You'd have to add to that any instruments which the particular surgeon required, and there were a number of surgeons. In the sterilizing room, we had big drums in which were towels and sheets, and you'd have to take out these sterile towels and place them onto mobile tables about the size of these.
So about 4 foot by 2 foot six.
Yeah. And take the instruments out from the sterilizer and place them in the proper order on the table. And then that would be wheeled out into the theatre ready for the what operation was going to happen.
Wouldn't be doing the handing to the surgeon, you'd just be preparing a sterile set of at that stage.
Yeah.
And what was the sterilizing equipment like? I mean, how did you operate it? Was it
easy? Well, we'd got a huge sterilizer, about 18 inches, 2 foot deep, and about 2 foot six by 2 foot, in which you could put kidney dishes, big trays that you required to be sterile and so on. And then there were two small sterilizers where the instruments went. They were on special trays that were laid in and drawn out. And we do an average of 14 operations a day in the two theatres. I was only there a couple of weeks.
Anything happen, or was it just learning these new duties as a steriliser?
Yeah, I was just, as we would say, a makey learn.
Anything else happened? Sorry, you were still living where were you living? Back at home still?
Back at home.
And reporting to Stonehouse Hospital?
Yeah, to the theatre. We would start, we worked two watches. We would start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and my job at that stage would be to take the brasso and clean up all the brass on the fire extinguishers and anything else, doorknobs and so on around, before the rest of the work for the day. We got a big kitchen in which the kettle was always going, there was always tea, because there were upwards of so I should think 15 men on the staff. And then in the sisters' quarters, there were three sisters and two VADs. And if we were watch ashore, as we called it, you'd work from 7 a.m. till 1:30, and then you'd be able to go ashore. I would go home, mother would have my dinner ready for me, and then I'd have to be back on board for 7 o'clock the next morning. Well, the next day, 7 o'clock, you'd work right through until work finished, and quite often that meant working all night, because we would do our normal operating list, and then we would get casualties coming in. Somebody'd fallen down a ladder in the dockyard, or fallen in a ship, or an aircraft had crashed in the Sound and injured would be brought in. You didn't know what you were going to get, but you were kept busy. Our normal operating list would finish around 4 or 5 o'clock, and then we would have to go on the surgical wards and do the pre-operative preps.
Now, tell me about them.
Well, for an ordinary abdominal, the patient would have to bath first. You'd then get the patient on the bed and shave his body. That meant shaving all the pubic hair and so on, and the legs. And then, according to the wishes of the surgeon, you would either use iodine or acriflavine to paint from the waist right down the legs, front and back. And then you'd take with you a drum containing sterile equipment. You'd already placed the patient on a sterile sheet. You'd then have to wrap a many-tail bandage around the patient.
If it was a bandage?
A many-tailed. It's many-tailed because it's made with many tails. You'd fold over one side, the other side, the other side. It had a complete set at the back, but the sides you folded round. So that would be the patient ready for operation to be brought up the next day. If it was a knee operation, you had a special routine. You did a 3-day prep. You went down, you shaved as usual, and then according to the leg you were going to do, you'd shave all the hair down the leg, make sure the toenails had been trimmed and everything, and then you had to use surgical spirit. Oh, you use surgical spirit on the others before putting the iodine or acriflavine on. But with a leg, you've got the leg on a sterile towel, and you do it with surgical spirit, and then with iodine or acriflavine, and then you've got a long linen stocking which came right up to the hip. And that would be put over and fastened around the top with a bandage. The second night and the third night, you would go down and you repeat the process. Take it off and do it again. The reason being that if you were going to operate on a knee, it had to be absolutely sterile. Because if you got an infection in the knee, you'd very likely end up with a stiff leg. When a knee patient came into the theatre, you'd have to drain the blood out of that leg. This was done by having what was called an Ismark bandage. This is a thick rubber bandage, about 3 inches in width, and you'd start at the toes, and you'd, using all your power, you'd wrap this Ismark bandage around the foot, all the way up the leg, up to the hip. And there you put a tourniquet on. This is in the theatre. This is while the patient is...
How do you spell Esmarch? Or do you know
E-S-M-A-R-C-H. As I remember it. I think that's right.
So again, that's for the knee.
Yeah. To start with, you put the knee... The patient is on the operating table and the anaesthetist is starting work. You take that leg and put it up vertical to let drain the blood. And you keep it in the vertical position while you're putting the bandage on. And a tourniquet goes around the femur. When the surgeon opens up a knee, not a sign of blood anywhere. It's as clean as can be. They can then take out the semilunar meniscus, if it's a cartilage, and this often happens, particularly with footballers. So the operation is done without any blood. And it has to be done quickly because you can't keep a tourniquet on a leg more than 30 minutes. So that was... Now, I was only in the theatre a couple of weeks when the chief petty officer said, Christmas leave. You're on first leave for Christmas. You'll be going to leave on Monday. So I got my 7 days leave. And when I came back...
That seems very early on.
Yeah, December.
You'd only been in a month or so. Yeah. Do you remember anything about your Christmas leave? Or?
No, not that Christmas. I don't remember any much about that.
Now, were you doing anything like any training at all as a sort of sailor? I mean, were you doing, dressing, drill?
No, I did no barracks, no square bashing, nothing at all. And I did no...
No seamanship?
No technical training as a sick birth attendant.
So what happens next then? You're working as an untrained theatre.
Presumably a trained theatre hand. And when I came back, the chief said, you're on draft. Now, this is just what I didn't want.
Why not?
Well, I had visions of being sent to a ship and being in charge of the operating procedures, and I was quite new to it. They pulled my leg. They said, it's a ship with wooden walls. It turned out that the wooden walls were huts. HMS Raleigh was being built across the River Tamar in Torpoint as a training base for new entries, stokers and seamen and so on.
Now, when did you go there? That would be January then, would it?
Early January.
40.
Yeah. Fortunately, a leading hand who'd been 9 years in the service was sent with me. He was an operating specialist as well. And there were several sick birth staff. They were all new to the Navy. They'd been St. John's ambulance men, nearly all from the Midlands or the north of England. Some of them had been miners. They're an interesting bunch, but nice lads.
And what happened when you got there? How were you received when you joined HMS Raleigh?
It was still being built. We'd got a wooden hut as a surgical ward, and the end of the hut had been partitioned off for an operating theatre. And we were there for 3 months before any trainees came. We'd got nothing to do. We used to stand around all day, and our favourite game was to stand with your back against the radiator and call to somebody on another radiator and run across before somebody else could pinch your place. A silly little game. I can't remember any of the others we played.
So what were you living in? Were you living in the same hut that you were...
We were living in an adjoining hut.
Now tell me what that hut was like. What was the accommodation like?
Well, there were two-tier bunks. And there were rows and rows of these huts, and some were still not built. And the main buildings, they'd got a canteen, dining hall.
Now, how was your hut laid out? So you got these double bunks, but...
And with a metal locker beside each bunk.
Down the side of each wall with the bed?
Yes.
Stove? Heating?
Oh, yeah, there was some heat there. I can't remember it being cold. It was winter time. So we had that for 3 months before any cases came, any new entries.
And you were getting no training?
No.
So you really were just hanging about?
Yeah.
Now, how did you get on with the other lads? Tell me,
talk a bit about them. Oh, quite well. Quite well. They were a nice bunch.
Any particular friends? Or just give us an idea what they were like.
Well, my particular friend was Bob Humphreys, who'd worked for the railway and lived in Crewe. And Alec Naylor, who'd been a miner, he was a big chap, and came from Tyneside. And if he shook your hand, you'd think your arm was coming off. He was really strong. And like several of the others, they'd got black marks in their skin where they'd had injuries in the mines.
Well, the coldest had got into
the cold had got in, yeah.
Now, from the sound of it, you got on well with them. I mean,
oh yeah,
same sort of,
yeah.
No bullying then, obviously.
No, not a bit. No.
What about the instructors, or were they just not present? I mean, you weren't doing anything, so did you have any sort of instructors you were aware of?
No, only Bogie Knight, who was the leading hand, the killick. Who I went over with, we did start classes.
Now, what were they?
First aid and general nursing.
Now, tell me, what were you learning in the first aid classes?
Well, these other chaps were St John's Ambulance, so they were first aiders, so they'd got some knowledge, and I picked up some knowledge from them.
So how would you define, what skills were they teaching you in the first aid classes? I mean, how far did they go?
How to deal with casualties, principally. How to put a patient in the recovery position and so on. How to put dressings on. General first aid work.
And what about the general nursing? What were they learning there?
We were given a sick birth staff manual, which was quite a big, thick book, which contained all the instructions necessary for dealing with surgical, medical, whatever. I spent my time learning what was in the book. And I'd also got, was it Durell and Fordry? I'd got a civilian nursing book. And I'd got two catalogues, which I'd taken from the hospital, the civilian hospital, which were all the surgical instruments and equipment. So I got plenty of literature to refer to. We were in these huts for some months while the permanent sick quarters were being built. The permanent sick quarters were outside HMS Raleigh, the other side of the road. There was an artificer's training establishment called HMS Fisguard, F-I-S Guard, and the sick quarters were built alongside that.
And when did you move into them?
It would be late-ish in 1940.
Now, were those huts very different? Or?
Yes, they were. We got proper hospital equipment, hospital beds, and so on, and trolleys to move patients about on, and we'd got offices, and we'd got an x-ray department, a laboratory, and an operating theatre suite.
Now, this was what was this known as? It was the training, medical training, and stuff, or what was it?
No, RN sick quarters. HMS Raleigh.
It was still, although it was the other side of Fishguard,
it was still called Raleigh. And we were still messed across in Raleigh. We'd go there for our meals.